I'm Massimo Bottura.
This is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs.
The positive side is what you know as well. This is the hardest working, most creative, most determined group of people I know. Just seeing some of the things that people have already come up with, either as a way of getting their own businesses through or to help others who are much worse off, it's inspiring.
The date is May 5th, 2020, and that is Lisa Abend, journalist, author, and contributing writer for Vanity Fair, our guest on this special report of Andrew Talks to Chefs. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is a special report of Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman. As always, our great thanks to Sam Pellegrino for covering the production cost of these special reports. We wouldn't have been able to deliver them to you without them. Our guest today is Lisa Abend. Lisa is an American writer living in Copenhagen. I first met Lisa 10 years ago when we were both covering the Bocuse d'Or cooking competition, and we both were spending time around the Napa Valley and around the French Laundry where the team was training, and then some time in Lyon, and we got to know each other. We became friends. We've stayed in touch intermittently over the years. At the time, Lisa was based in Spain. She actually wrote a book not long after we met called The Sorcerer's Apprentices about a group of stages at Ferran Adrià's restaurant, El Bulli. Recently, Lisa's been doing some invaluable global reporting on how the pandemic and lockdown around the world has affected the restaurant industry and its prospects for Vanity Fair. I will link to the three pieces that she's filed in just the last few weeks, but many of you have probably seen some of them. One was about the sort of initial shock and awe for the industry when the pandemic hit and what the prospects for the industry might be. Another was about how chefs have leaped into action at this time of great peril and precariousness to themselves and their own businesses to help others both within their industry and outside of it. And then a piece about a topic that I find fascinating, which is Sweden's approach to the pandemic, which is very unique among industrialized Western countries, and how that is reflected in the restaurant industry there and what lessons we all might be able to take out of that example. So that's what our conversation covers. It's a bit of a dialogue. We are old friends. We both cover this industry, so it is more of a give and take than a lot of these interviews tend to be. And that's all I think I need to say about it. So with that, here is my conversation with Lisa Abend. Before we start talking about some of the things you've been covering recently, can you just give me a sense of what life is like there in Copenhagen?
Yeah, it's actually, I think, looking at it globally, I think we've been fairly lucky and well off. The government here acted very decisively on about March 11th and closed schools, closed restaurants and bars, most cultural venues. And it came and also closed the borders of the country soon after that. So it was a pretty firm and decisive lockdown, but she had completely united support from all of the other political parties. And Danes on the whole seemed to be quite appreciative of how she responded and of the transparency. It hasn't really been politicized here in the same way as it has been in the U.S. On top of that, we've always been able to go out for walks. They didn't take those away, unlike other countries in Europe. And the weather's been beautiful this spring. So it's never felt too gloomy. On top of that, of course, it's important to say that the case numbers have been relatively low.
You know, it's been really interesting to watch your stories, the progression of your output for Vanity Fair. You know, I went to print the articles that I'd been reading in the last several weeks, and then I saw the articles that were a little bit further back. And it was, you know, they were stories that I think would fall into, you know, what one would expect of someone covering the global, you know, chef and restaurant scene. You know, there was a story about the people trying to take over the Spotted Pig. There was a story about one of the sort of food, the annual food events that goes on. And then there was this just absolutely abrupt shift. And some of the pieces you've done, I have to say the quotes are just, I mean, I'll hear them for the rest of my life. The headline of the one you ran in late March, you can't speak in strong enough dystopian words to describe it. I mean, this was just weeks after, you know, what we would call sort of the, you know, the normal reporting. And I think it reflects the shift most of us, you know, felt in our, and just our lives. I mean, around the world. How soon did you get a sense of what the sort of threads were that you might be following in these months that are kind of unspooling before us?
I think very early on, of course, anybody who writes about restaurants is going to realize that they would be in trouble. Anybody who has any real knowledge of that, because one of the first things you learn about restaurants from the business angle is how thin the profit margins are. So I already knew that they would not, that most restaurants, even the ones that we think of as being the most successful, the most famous, the ones that whose bookings fill up months in advance, I did know that even those would be in trouble, that they wouldn't have the kinds of reserves you might see in other businesses. What came as a surprise is just how narrow those reserves were, to have chefs say things to me like, I can't make it through one weekend without income, came as something of a surprise. And the quote that you mentioned, which was from Dan Barber, he was referring to what this would do down the supply chain, that this, I think he also said that this would be the end of farm to table, because those farms who have been supplying restaurants would no longer be able to make it either, even past a couple of weeks.
Well, it's interesting, right? Because when you talk about those margins, as crazy as that sounds for the industry, that they've been able to live on this razor's edge for so long, you know, somebody said to me the other day that, you know, what that means is, you know, 90 cents or maybe even more than that of every dollar is going out to places like farms and purveyors, that's the rest of the margin equation, you know? So to Dan's point, you know, the margins are so thin, it's not that these people are gouging restaurants, it's just that they feel they can only charge so much for a meal. At least that's my understanding of the reason behind it.
Yeah, and, you know, and that's definitely one of the threads that is coming out of this. And, you know, I've heard chefs and restaurateurs and investors say to me that, you know, one of the lessons is that they need to be charging more for food.
Yeah. I mean, and not just, I mean, I've heard this from a number of chefs in these special reports that not just for the, I mean, people, of course, talk about all these employees now who are, you know, in the lurch. And I mean, that to me, I mean, that's what I think of all the time, is so many people who have trained for a life in restaurants. If those jobs go away, I mean, you I'm sure you hear it all the time when you interview cooks. I mean, you wrote a whole book about, you know, the team at El Bulli years ago. You know, a lot of people who find the kitchen, they don't really feel like they belong anywhere. They've been training for this since they were teenagers. You know, if there's these mass closings, I wonder where those people go. But from a bottom line economic standpoint, you know, health insurance, salary, and then just, you know, some kind of a war chest or reserve, whatever you want to call it, money in the bank. I mean, we're all seeing that just doesn't exist. It is pretty astonishing to step back and see it.
It is. And, you know, actually one thing, a question that I have for you about this, because one of the things that does make this so difficult to work as a business, as you said, is just the number of staff that are have been sort of pulled into this industry in the last couple of decades. And I know that in, especially in top end restaurants, there's just a lot of them. A kitchen like Noma is going to have 35, 40 cooks in there. And I wonder, and you might be a person to answer this, is that a recent phenomenon? Did kitchens at the top level always have so many people? Because that has got to be part of the reason why they don't make more money than they do.
Wow, that's a great question. My instinct is that they haven't had benches that deep in the past. I think part of it is, you know, there's this funny, I can't say who either of them were. I'll tell you after we're stopped recording. But years ago, I was talking to somebody who had, I think, 2 Michelin stars, and I had just had a meal on the road that was a 3 Michelin star meal. And I was showing this person, the 2 Michelin star chefs, some photographs. And the response to it was of the food, which I thought was quite stunning. And the chef said to me, well, I could do the same thing if I had 20 unpaid people in my basement also, you know, which is the rest of right. what you're talking about, which is, you know, the fact that so many people will go, you know, go around the world chasing these stages and work for nothing, you know, maybe not for very long, but they'll move around doing that. These are very accomplished technicians. But I think part of the reason for what you're talking about, I think it's 2 things. I think one is the, what would we call it, the graphic ambition or the visual ambition, the presentation ambition of the food that we see today is much more intricate and complicated than anything that existed before 20, 30 years ago. And that really? Takes labor. I mean, that just takes hands. And then I think the other thing is service has evolved. I mean, you have restaurants now that have, you know, they don't just have a wine program. They have a wine program and they have a whatever you want to call it, a beverage or mixology program. And they have a coffee and tea program, you know, and they have
a fermentation program as well.
Fermentation programs. And there's a person leading those. And then there's people who, you know, who execute them, you know, and some of these, I mean, a lot of the places we're talking about are 5-day-a-week operations, but it's dinner only in some cities. And I mean, how does that work economically? You mentioned Amanda Cohen. I mean, she made this comment to me in an interview years ago, you know, about people looking for other ways to use their restaurants. And she said to me, you know, I only serve dinner 7 nights a week, but I pay rent 24/7, you know? And so all these, you know, all these things have required more, like we say, more bodies and more hands. I can't imagine why a restaurant in the more classic mode serving, I mean, certainly if you go back pre-Nouvelle Cuisine, but even, you know, I would say even into maybe the 90s, I just don't know why you would need all these people, you know? I just don't think the vision required it. And I do think the glamour is, you know, there was the glamorization of the business that happened in the, I'm sorry, this is your interview and I'm talking too much.
No.
But you asked me a question. But,
I did.
But you know, I think the glamorization that happened in the 80s and 90s, you know, that was one kind of glamorization. That was the television, the celebrity thing, all of that. I think it, more recently, what we've seen is a different kind of glamorization, and maybe we would call it the noblization, you know, of service, you know, and cooking. And this actually is a nice segue into another piece you wrote, but you know, there are all these stories that, I mean, it all gets very cliched very quickly, but you know, people have been drawn to this industry almost like a calling today, whereas I think years ago, it was for a lot of people more of a sanctuary, you know? And so I think that's drawn a lot of people. I mean, you always had cooks who were willing to be in the back of the house for free, but then you have now service, you know, people who work in the dining rooms who have
absolutely
have the kind of ambitions we used to associate with chefs, you know, who want to be great service people, who want to be the next, you know, they want to be the next Will Goddard, they want to be the next whoever, you know, fill in the blank. And that's new.
Yes, I completely agree. And I think, I mean, what you said about the sort of visual nature of food, this is something I've thought about a lot, and that I'll be very interested to see if this changes in the wake of the pandemic and of this crisis, which is, there's been this, a kind of acceptance of the a shared value of perfection. And maybe it starts with Robichon and all of those dots, perhaps, but certainly at El Bulli and then later with Noma and other restaurants working at that level, when you ask them, you know, why do you need to put in, you know, why do you need somebody who's willing to work 16 hours a day? Why do you need so many hands? Why does, you know, why do you need tweezers? Why does everything, why do you need that like thin line of perfectly minced chervil leaves on the edge of something? And that is, it's because that is the aesthetic, right? That is, it is what we take to be perfection in the within a certain level of fine dining right now. But perfection, A, doesn't exist, and B, is subjective. What we know is that, you know, there's a kind of absolute obsessive attention to detail that can, that is highlighted in a lot of these restaurants, but that does require tremendous amount of labor. And whether it's free or not, I'm not sure anyone's going to be able to do that anymore. Already, I mean, we've seen here restaurants, many restaurants have had like sent their stages home from the beginning of the crisis. They don't have those hands. They're working with half the staff that they did before.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one thing I think that when you said, you know, you'll be interested to see how this aspect of it shakes out. I mean, over the, I mean, I'll speak just to the last, you know, 35, 40 years, but, you know, there have been these periods where the style of what people are looking to consume has changed. You know, there was the financial crash in the late 1980s, and a lot of restaurants in New York City that were kind of, you know, flavor of the month, you know, the places getting all the attention, a lot of them didn't make it out of that period. You know, after the September 11 attacks in New York City, you know, if you go back and look at when the whole kind of movement toward comfort food started to really take hold, and when that was like all these cookbooks of so-and-so cooks at home, you know, that whole run of cookbooks that all these great chefs were doing, that was right after September 11th. And I think there probably is going to be a similar shift after this toward, you know, this again, this is one of these very quotable lines. It's the last line of one of your other pieces where it said, you know, the chef saying sometimes it's nice not to have foodies in the restaurant. You know, I think at times like this, well, A, of course, there's the financial component, right? Are people going to be able to pay for these kind of dinners, the people for whom they were real splurges, right? But then I think there's just I think it all starts to kind of wind back to the more primal aspect of why we eat, why we go to a restaurant. You know, that it's at a fundamental level, it's to eat food that someone's prepared for you and do it in a communal setting. That's kind of it. I mean, that's the core transaction. Yeah. That's the core thing we're looking for. I think, I can't say what it is on the show because it's way too crude, but I have a friend who used to talk about food that just got, you know, more and more extravagant and more outlandish from a presentation standpoint. And, you know, he compared it to sort of people's kinks, you know, like people who, you know, you're in a relationship for a long time and then you, you know, things just kind of get a little, you know, 50 Shades of Black-ish, you know, but and this was a fairly accomplished chef who said this to me once over dinner somewhere. But I do think that these trends toward the extravagant do correspond with relatively good times financially.
That's no doubt true, and I think you're right that there is that I think we all sort of intuitively understand this, that when we are able to go out to restaurants again, certainly not the thing that I'm fantasizing about or looking forward to is, you know, a 18-course tasting menu. That I think Renee Redzepi said that in the story I did recently, that, you know, when he thinks about it, he doesn't want to sit down to some in some formal setting. He wants to just be out with his friends, eating a huge shellfish platter and ordering a couple of bottles of champagne. I think that's something that we can all probably sympathize with.
I mean, I do wonder, you know, I've had people say to me recently that they think, you know, the super fine dining restaurants in some respects are built to come out of this because the tables are already spaced pretty well. They already cater to an affluent population.
They have investors usually.
They have investors who might be able to help them ride it out. So I don't know. What do you think about that?
It's funny you should ask because I was just today speaking with Ferran Andrea about this. And he said, I keep getting asked this question too. Is this the death of fine dining? And I say, no, there's just going to be a lot fewer places to do it. And I suspect that he's right, that that there will be a significant number of that sort of top tier of restaurants that doesn't make it out of this crisis alive. But as long as there are wealthy people, as long as there are people who want that degree of luxury, and there will always be some of them, there will be fine dining restaurants.
Yeah. I mean, there is a part of me that can see, you know, not to generalize or stereotype, but I live in New York and, you know, there is a part of me that can see people who live in the Upper East Side, you know, as soon as it's safe, you know, pronounced safe to do so, waltzing right back into these places that are, you know, several hundred dollars ahead to have dinner. I mean, like on day one, I have no trouble imagining that.
No, nor do I. I think it's more the sort of middle classes, upper middle classes who have in the last decade or so turned eating out into, you know, a pretty regular and very prominent form of entertainment. And that's I think is the question. What happens to them? Will they still go out to eat? Absolutely. Will they decide to build their summer vacation around a trip to Scandinavia so they can eat in certain places? That I don't know.
Can we talk about Sweden for a moment?
Yes.
You wrote this piece about, you know, Sweden's restaurants never having closed. I keep reading articles about Sweden, and I can't decide. I mean, you talked about how decisive the government was where you are. You know, in its own way, so was Sweden's. Although, you know, I keep seeing these photographs of people walking down the street, and I keep reading articles about, you know, how the caseloads aren't that much worse than they are anywhere else. In some cases, not as bad. Do you have if you don't mind my asking, do you have a personal opinion about the approach they took? Are the rest of us nuts, or are they just lucky? Where do you net out on this? Because I have to say, I look at it and I go, you know, it seems to me there's an argument for it.
I think that there's a really important caveat here, which I did not realize until I did the reporting for that story. And I was speaking, this was Nicholas Ekstedt, who said to me, the thing that people don't understand in the rest of the world is that for Swedes, when your government recommends something, you do it. They don't need to pass a law. So they don't need necessarily to close down restaurants and bars. This was his argument, because they've recommended that you put in place certain hygiene practices and that you maintain distances, and we all do it. It's not, there's nobody showing up on the, you know, the state house in Stockholm waving guns and complaining about this. They trust their government. So that, I think, is an important thing to keep in mind.
So they haven't done a full shutdown, but they're living very responsibly.
That was his argument. And I do think that there is something to that. At the same time, I have seen videos of, you know, parts of Stockholm that are more crowded, or a friend sent me a video of a group of young people out at a restaurant, definitely not maintaining social distancing. So I don't think that it's perfect, but I think it is something to keep in mind, that that there is a certain, a much greater degree of trust in government there, and that even with just something being recommended, people will follow those instructions.
So, I mean, you've been talking to people all over the world for these stories, Lisa. What's your, where are you in your, I mean, I've been riding sort of a sine curve or a sine wave of outlook. What's your, if I put it out there very broadly, are you optimistic, pessimistic, too? It's, you know, as the old Magic 8-Ball said, unclear. Where are you this week in terms of your outlook for the industry?
Like all of us, I go up and down on this. Right now, as you're seeing things start to reopen, there's a lot of concern, and it is really hard to see how restaurants are going to be able to make it work under this, especially in this sort of weird in-between time. Because what you're seeing now, this has not happened in Denmark, but it is happening in other European countries, and in certain states in the US as well, that, you know, they're allowing for these partial reopenings. So in Spain, for example, restaurants are going to be able to open for outdoor seating, but only at a third of their capacity. At the same time, that means pulling people back, because here, remember, many of the governments in Western Europe basically stepped in and covered salaries up to a certain percent. In Denmark, it's 90%. So for those places to call their staff back means they're going to be assuming the salaries again, but with the ability to only, you know, to only serve a much reduced number of guests. Nobody sees how that's going to work. I don't see how that's going to work unless there's, you know, more, some new kind of deal from the government or partial unemployment. I don't know what that's going to look like. But certainly a lot of places now are having to weigh this decision. Is it better to just stay closed, because this way they know at least that their employees are being covered? So that, I think, is the negative side. The positive side is what you know as well. This is like the hardest working, most creative, most determined group of people I know. And just seeing some of the things that people have already come up with, either as a way of getting their own businesses through or to help others who are much worse off. I mean, it's inspiring, and I have every faith that there will continue to be those kind of initiatives, and all of that hard work and imagination and drive will get at least some people through it.
I agree. Well, on that note, I'm going to thank you for calling in. Again, thanks for all the great stories. It's really been, I mean, for me, it's one of the ways I've been staying in touch with what's happening all over the globe in this industry that I, you know, love to follow and love to experience when we're able to do that. So thanks for all the great reporting.
Really nice to hear. Thank you.
And we'll talk again soon. Thank you, Lisa.
Thanks for having me on.
And that's our show for today. Again, my great thanks to Lisa Abman for being our guest. Lisa, it was great to hear your voice. Great to chat a little before and after the interview. And I'm glad I was able to share your thoughts and observations from speaking to chefs all around the globe. For your articles, I look forward to the next ones. And again, for anybody who hasn't read those pieces, they will be linked to from the episode page for my conversation with Lisa at the AndrewTalksToChefs.com website, or from the Apple podcast description of today's episode. Again, we'd love it if you please checked out our Patreon page and considered supporting this show directly. The address is Patreon, patreon.com/AndrewTalksToChefs. If you enjoyed this show, please explore our archives at AndrewTalksToChefs.com or on your favorite podcast platform. Please subscribe to the show. It is free, and episodes will automatically appear in your podcast queue. And please tell your friends. Thanks to Wild Turkey Surprise for today's opening music and to After School Special for the music you're listening to right now. Please seek them out online and enjoy more of their music. Thanks to our engineer, Margaret Kelly, for mixing these special reports. Our thanks to Sam Pellegrino for making these special reports possible. And thank you to all of you for listening. Please take care of yourselves, take a breath, and we will all get through this together. See you tomorrow.